Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour, we'll follow in the footsteps of a journalist targeted by a Mexican drug cartel and climb Mount Everest with an American team trying to build the nation's confidence at the height of the Cold War. It's the second installment of Steve's Bookshelf. I'll chat with the authors of four books on my reading list this summer and hopefully give you some ideas for your own nightstand. The astronauts launched into space during the Mercury 7 missions weren't the only ones thrust into the spotlight. We'll hear the stories of their wives. But first, we'll go behind the lines of the pivotal Battle of Bunker Hill during the Revolutionary War. With us to talk about his book, Bunker Hill, is Nathaniel Philbrick. He's a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a National Book Award winner, and he's written extensively about sailing and history. He was last on this show in 2007 to talk about his book on the Mayflower. And Nathaniel, welcome back. Nice to have you again.
It's great to be back.
This was the bloodiest battle of the Revolutionary War. Why was it so important?
Well, it was really where what was a disagreement between an empire and her colonies went from a group of skirmishes, which occurred at Lexington and Concord, to all-out war. And so the Battle of Bunker Hill was a real turning point where it went from a revolution into really a war of independence.
And so really, after this battle, Nathaniel, there's really no turning back, right?
Right. And, you know, and it became clear that everyone was going to have to change their strategy, particularly when it came to the British, who decided upon hearing about this battle back in England that it was time to eventually pull out of Boston and move elsewhere, eventually to New York. But it was really Bunker Hill where the whole tenor of things when it came between Britain and the American colonies changed.
And the dispute at that point was what? Because, and maybe you should describe what life was like in Boston during this time, because it was pretty oppressive.
Yeah, well, you know, Boston was completely different from what it is today. It was an island connected by a thin neck of land to the mainland, just a square mile with about 15,000 people. And after the Boston Tea Party, Britain responded with the Boston Port Act and a series of acts that became known as the Intolerable Act.
Right.
Life in Boston became very difficult. Thousands of British soldiers were sent into the city, almost 9,000 of them occupying the city, as Patriot inhabitants fled, and all economic activity ceased. Tensions were mounting throughout the countryside. Lexington, Concord erupt. And it's just really is oppressive because, you know, there's just no way to make a living. And people are getting tenser and tenser. And with that many troops in the city, life was very difficult.
I was going to say, it doesn't sound like much fun to be in Boston back then.
No. You know, and what's interesting, we all think of Boston as the center of patriot defiance, which it was in the beginning with the Boston Massacre and the Tea Party. But with the arrival of these troops, it changes, and Boston becomes a city under military occupation. And, you know, what we see in Iraq is happening in Boston, where the townspeople are not appreciating presence of a military force, and the soldiers are not enjoying that either. And so it really made for a cauldron of escalating tension.
We're visiting with Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, Bunker Hill. So just how bloody was the Battle of Bunker Hill?
Well, you know, it was a battle like none other, really, in the Revolution. It was literally the bloodiest battle of the Revolution. More people would die. There were more than 2,000 British soldiers against more than that provincial soldiers. The provincial soldiers, the Patriots, were dug in the Charlestown Peninsula, just across Boston Harbor from the city. And 2,000 British regulars were rowed across, and it would take them three different charges against the dug-in provincial soldiers. And eventually they would take the earthen redoubt that the Patriots had built the night before and technically win the Battle of Bunker Hill. But the British soldiers would suffer casualties of 50%, half of them either killed or wounded. And as General Howe, who led the forces on the ground during that battle, would say, the success was too dearly bought. And it was really a Pyrrhic victory and was a wake-up call. Because up until this point, everyone thought, well, if these militiamen, these farmers who are pretending to be soldiers, ever meet the awesome might of a professional British army, they'll turn and run. And they didn't turn and run. It took three different charges, and so everything was different.
I was going to say, this wasn't supposed to happen. Just what you said about the Americans were supposed to be just, you know, like going up against a battle of a troop of Boy Scouts, as opposed to something else entirely, as what the British found out back on those days.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it was the British were very used to squashing rebellions. I mean, they had dealt with the Highlanders in Scotland and stopped rebellions in Ireland, and so they were used to doing this. But what they didn't take into account was that each town in Massachusetts had its militia, and these men were used to handling weapons. And once they were dug in, they were very resolved in their resistance. And so it was a real wake-up call for the British, and was a real rallying cry for the colonial forces, because now they knew they were in for something different, something that no one had expected, a war that would eventually lead to their own independence.
So, Nathaniel, then how did the British react to what happened at Bunker Hill? How taken aback, how discouraged, perhaps, were they by what happened
there? It was morale in Boston was terrible, because they were the town was flooded with wounded and dying men. And food was increasingly hard to get because they were surrounded by militia forces. And once word got back to England, the decision was made that they must evacuate. The problem was they didn't have enough boats to get everyone out. And so this turned into a stalemate, a siege that would last for almost a year. And things were very grim within Boston, particularly since everyone knew that there were thousands of provincial soldiers surrounding them.
Hmm. You know, one of the central figures in this book is a man named Joseph Warren. Who was he, and why has he been forgotten by history? Because some folks have referred to him as something of the forgotten founding father.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. You know, we think of John Hancock, John Adams, and Sam Adams as kind of the leaders of the Patriot movement in Boston. But the fact of the matter is they were away during most of the crucial times during this period at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. And it would be left to this 33-year-old doctor, Joseph Warren, a widower with four kids between the ages of 2 and 8, to lead the on-the-ground revolution. And, you know, we all know the name Paul Revere, but we don't know who gave him the orders to alert the countryside that the British were coming.
And it was Joseph Warren. Yeah.
It was Joseph Warren. He was the only remaining Patriot leader in Boston on the night of April 18, before history would be made with Lexington and Concord.
So why don't we recall him today?
Well, the tragedy of
are you going to change all that here?
Yeah, well, you know, hopefully his story will get a little bit more traction when it comes to the American public, because it really deserves to be. And, you know, he was the head of the provincial Congress in the months after Lexington and Concord. He was made a major general, but he would die in the Battle of Bunker Hill on the third and final British charge. And as a consequence, he wasn't around to be one of those founding fathers. And you know, and adding to that was he was replaced by none other than George Washington a couple of weeks later. And so when a man of that stature steps in, I guess it's not surprising that Joseph Warren, even though he had done so much, is no longer remembered as he probably should be.
Now, I should point out that I think I read that Ben Affleck, the big Hollywood star, already has optioned your book for a film, Nathaniel. And so is he going to play Joseph Warren? Are you going to play Joseph Warren? Where are we going here?
At this stage, I have no idea. I can't think of a director in Hollywood who knows Boston better than Ben Affleck. It's really great to know that he has interest in this project. But beyond that, the dust really hasn't settled, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, maybe the bigger question is, who do you think should play Joseph Warren?
You know, I'm terrible at that game. You know, I look back and, you know, you know, I just can't go there because, you know, I love movies, but when it comes to knowing the names of the actors, I'm pretty pitiful.
Yeah, you know, I'm always struck by how great folks like yourself, and I always have such reverence for historians and the work that people like you do, Nathaniel, maybe because my dad is a writer, and I just sort of know a little bit about the process and the struggles and everything else. And I'm just wondering, how did you go about researching this era, this time, and for that matter, Joseph Warren, and how do you go about researching this battle, given how long ago it took place?
Yeah, well, each one of my books is basically a 3-year process, and it's the first year where I really dig in with the research, go to the archives. There are many of them in Boston, the Massachusetts Historical Society, the Bostonian Society. It goes on and on. But I also, with this book, really wanted to create a sense of what Boston was like during the Revolution. So I worked with a lot of period maps. And, you know, Boston has changed so much. It's unrecognizable now. Mm-hmm. What's now known as the Back Bay, a neighborhood, was then the Back Bay. It was water. You know, water lapped up onto Boston Common. And so I used a lot of maps. Actually walked around Boston quite a bit, trying to piece the various pieces together and create a sense of what Boston was like. I also went out to places like Lexington and Concord and Dorchester Heights, all of which figure into this book. And for me, research is as much getting out there and looking at the terrain as it is digging into the archives.
And even though the terrain has changed so much, Nathaniel, can you make sense of it by walking the land today?
Yeah, it's interesting. What's known as Washington Street is sort of still a main drag into Boston, and that was the street that went across the neck, that thin neck of land that led into the island that was Boston. And so when you walk Washington Street, it's very interesting. You pass where there's a memorial to the Liberty Tree. You pass the Old South Meeting, where the residents of Boston gathered just before the Boston Tea Party. It's still there. You know, places like that still remain. And the other thing is that Boston Harbor figures large in this, and there's islands dotting Boston Harbor. And if you ever fly in or out of Boston and see those islands spread out before you, you're basically seeing what existed in 1775. And so, you know, it's fun for me to take the hints we have today and try to peel back all the change that's occurred over the last more than 200 years and try to get at the essence of what Boston was like during this period.
Well, it's a great story. Again, Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of the new book, Bunker Hill. He's a Pulitzer winner. He's been here before. His work is just absolutely top-notch. And Nathaniel, just a pleasure to have you again, and good luck with the book, okay?
Well, thank you so much, and great to talk to you.
You bet. All the best.
Okay.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're running through a series of books from my bookshelf, some books that I'm especially interested in this summer and hoping I have time to read. Our next book is about Mount Everest, you know, with America on uncertain footing at the height of the Cold War. A group of climbers began a journey to Mount Everest to lift the country's spirits. In his new book, The Vast Unknown, Broughton Coburn takes us through this nerve-wracking trip. He's a writer and lecturer who studied Mount Everest and its Himalayan and surroundings in depth. He joins us this morning from Wilson, Wyoming. And Broughton, good morning.
Great to be here, Steve.
How much pressure was on these guys to reach the summit back in those days?
Well, in 1953, the British reached the top of Everest, and then in 1954, the Swiss also reached the summit. And so there was a lot of pressure for the Americans to follow suit. And oddly, it took a Swiss-American, a man named Norman Dürrenfurth, to have the vision to put together a team in 1963 that originally was going to climb three summits, Everest, neighboring Nüpse, and Lhotse. But on the way, they shifted their plans to climb Everest by two routes, including the unclimbed west ridge of Everest, a daunting undertaking.
Daunting because...
Well, the West Ridge is steep. It had never been climbed. Most of the expedition members felt that it was unclimbable and that making an attempt on it would jeopardize reaching the summit by the easier South Col route that the Swiss and the British had done. So they were skeptical and reticent to dedicate resources and supplemental oxygen to such a risky route.
What was going on in the country back in those days and really around the world, Broughton, that made this climb so important?
Well, much of the world was skeptical about America's role geopolitically. We were in the midst of the space race at the time. In 1958, the Russians had launched the satellite Sputnik, and America went space crazy. Mm-hmm. And that's when President Kennedy vowed that they would, the Americans would put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. At the same time, in 1962, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. The Berlin Wall was erected. We're in the midst of the civil rights movement. And there was also, specifically, right there in the Himalayas, the Sino-Indian War of 1962, and a tremendous amount of tension on the border between China or Tibet and India.
Hmm. So who's in the American group? Describe the members to us. It was like, what, 21 members large?
There were 21 members, and the first American on Everest, May 1st, 1963, was Jim Whittaker, Big Jim, as he was known, and a Nepalese Indian Sherpa named Nawang Gombu. And they were followed in within 3 weeks on May 22nd by Lute Gerstad and Barry Bishop, who reached the mountain by the traditional South Col route. And within a few hours were followed by Tom Hornbein and Willie Unsold, who reached the summit via this unclimbed West Ridge, and then did a traverse down the South Col route on a route they had never seen in darkness. Mm. And they became stuck out overnight in what has been termed the highest bivouac in history.
Wow. So the climbs were successful.
They were successful. After some divisiveness on the expedition,
yeah,
and some difficulty. I think that their success in many ways was due to the tremendous amount of teamwork that was involved. Nowadays, it seems you have climbers who are oriented toward individual achievement and individual comfort, even in the process of climbing. And on Everest, at least, you can almost dial in a climb. You can call up an outfitter in Nepal, and they ask you how many people you have, what food you like to eat, and how many bottles of oxygen you'd want.
Mm-hmm. We're visiting with Broughton Coburn about his new book, The Vast Unknown, about Americans climbing Everest back in the early 60s. When you talk about teamwork in climbing a mountain, what do you mean exactly? Because that's a concept that might confuse some folks.
Well, climbers in the early days of climbing referred to the brotherhood of the rope, they called it, that when you were roped together with another climber, you had a bond that linked you as even more than brothers. You became one climbing unit. And they all realized that their lives depended on the actions of others, and that they were in it together. That, and even more than that, I feel that there was a sense in America at the time that we needed to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We needed to revive our reputation globally, and I think that extended even to the climbers, who felt that this mountain could be climbed successfully only if they did it as a team and maintain the objective that getting any member of the team on the summit was the goal that would allow them to do that, not an individual in particular.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the tension along the way. In fact, at one point, there's even talk of mutiny. What caused all that tension? What was going on up on that mountain?
Well, much of it was the argument over the West Ridge. The West Ridge would have to be climbed almost simultaneously with the easier South Col route if they were to be able to reach the summit. But Norman Dierenfurth, the leader, made a unilateral decision that they would dedicate their resources first to the easy route, make sure that they got a successful summit party on top, and then if there was sufficient oxygen and food and time left over, they could make an attempt on the West Ridge. So with a very, very narrow window of time, oxygen, resources, including porters, many of the Sherpas had left the mountain. Tom Hornbein, who's still alive and well in Colorado, and Willie Unsold reached the summit in a climb that is still regarded as one of the greatest in mountaineering history.
And it's regarded as the greatest just because it was just so technically difficult?
Technically difficult, extending themselves with rudimentary equipment into mm-hmm. unknown terrain with limited support, limited backup at that time. It was interesting that while they were on the West Ridge at their next to highest camp, astronaut Gordon Cooper flew overhead, orbited overhead in Faith 7, the last mission of the Mercury program. And they were like the astronauts in the respect that they were on the frontier of human accomplishment in a way. And so the West Ridge has continued to be a difficult mm-hmm. route and dangerous, definitely. 14 people have reached the summit since 1963, and 14 or 15 have died in an attempt by that route. So it's a very dangerous route.
Are you a climber yourself?
I've done a fair amount of climbing. I ended up in the Himalayas working for a number of years with the World Bank and the UN and other projects, and so I shifted my attention for a while there to development work and conservation work. I saw that there was a tremendous need for that.
Have you ever wanted to climb Everest yourself?
I have thought about it, and I've had invitations to do so. It's interesting that I spoke with a high incarnate lama, a Buddhist lama, who has a monastery in the shadow of Mount Everest, and he advised me not to. He said that it's irresponsible, really, to put one's precious human life at risk for a simple recreation such as climbing a mountain.
So some of these climbers were still alive, and you were able to interview them.
Yes, 7 of the 21 are still alive, some very much so. Tom Hornbein, age 82, for many years was the director of anesthesiology at the University of Washington Medical School, and is retired in Colorado now. He was rock climbing a very difficult route, 5-8 difficulty level, just last year in Colorado. Another climber recently built an airplane from scratch, an aerobatic airplane, and he flies it and does loops and rolls over the sawtooths of Idaho, very close to Idaho's fifth highest mountain, which is named after the one expedition member who died on the expedition, wow. Jake Breitenbach. And on the second day of climbing, Jake Breitenbach, a Northwest climber, right. was killed in the ice fall right at the beginning of the climb.
Well, Broughton Coburn also writes about house-sized blocks of ice collapsing in the paths of these climbers. Just absolutely amazing stuff. Broughton Coburn's new book, The Vast Unknown. Thanks so much for your time today. I sure appreciate it.
You bet, Steve.
All the best, Broughton.
Thanks.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our journey through Steve's bookshelf. We'll turn to Mexican drug cartels and the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, we're talking about books today. Steve's bookshelf, our next guest, escaped death threats from a Mexican drug cartel while investigating the deadly drug trade in the country. Alfredo Corchado joins us from Mexico City to talk about his new book, Midnight in Mexico. He's the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he's reported from across the U.S., Mexico, and Cuba. Alfredo, good morning. So nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Why wasn't the Mexican government, you know, better able to control the drug cartels during the last decade or so? What happened?
Well, what happened when you had the changeover of government, you went from a regime that governed Mexico for 71 years to the first opposition government in the year 2000. And I think what happened was the power that was once very centralized suddenly moved to the states. And so it basically diversified, changed the whole dynamic. And all of a sudden you had the cartels negotiating or dealing with state governments, and that just created a whole power vacuum and the infighting. I mean, it just it worsened. From one point you had 2-3 cartels. These days as many as 70, 72 cartels exist.
Wow.
So, you know, the pie got smaller and the infighting just got bigger.
And you actually had cartels negotiating with the government, Alfredo?
Well, it's always been, I guess, a hush-hush secret in Mexico that, you know, in order for cartels to operate, you have to have some kind of agreement with members of the government, i.e. law enforcement officials, i.e. key politicians.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, you know, just let us take our stuff to the United States, and we look the other way. The agreement is we get some of the proceeds, and more importantly, try not to make too much of a mess. In other words, don't do too many killings, don't get too much attention, just kind of keep it normal, as normal as you can.
So why has the violence simply gotten out of control? What's your sense?
My sense is that you have... I think, you know, see, the thing that really changed the whole dynamic was when you had a paramilitary group. These were elite members who were trained, some by the U.S. government. They came back, and they became army deserters, started working for one of the cartels known as the GOP cartel. 35 members deserted. They became a private army. And these guys were much more about controlling the distribution routes. They weren't necessarily businessmen. Their thing was to control piracy, prostitution, human smuggling routes, extortions, kidnappings. And that really just changed the lay of the land in Mexico. You started seeing some of the most horrific crimes being committed. This is a little too graphic for maybe the listeners, but you started seeing bodies dangling from bridges and decapitated bodies. I mean, it went to a whole different level.
We're visiting with Alfredo Corchado, who joins us from Mexico City this morning about his new book, Midnight in Mexico. You know, when you first were assigned to Mexico, you didn't want to cover the drug cartels when you got the assignment. So how did you wind up right where you didn't want to be?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm born in Mexico, left as a six-year-old, grew up in California, and in El Paso. I'm a U.S. citizen. And I always had seen Mexico as, you know, covered by people that just seemed to promote the stereotypes of a country that was corrupt, violent, et cetera. So I guess I was in many ways like many Mexicans. I tried to live in denial and try to look at other issues, U.S.-Mexico policy, immigration, et cetera. But two things happened. The journalism industry went through a big economic crisis. We went from a bureau of 12 people to suddenly we were one.
Hmm.
And then the violence just got out of hand. So suddenly you didn't have a choice but to cover this. And when I started covering this, I realized, you know, one of the reasons why Mexico has not been able to really prosper as a nation is because of this issue, because of the corruption, because of these very weak institutions, rule of law, et cetera. And suddenly, I think for someone who has always been interested in seeing Mexico become a developed country and you know, and not have to send people abroad to the United States, I feel like, you know, it's bingo. This is really what holds Mexico back. So it almost became round-the-clock coverage from that point on. And I had actually promised my parents that I wouldn't cover these issues. But, I mean, it's something you can't really avoid.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of progress is being made today when it comes to getting a grip on the cartels down there? Are you seeing much progress or not really?
Well, this week you have probably the biggest thing that's happened in Mexico in the last few years. I mean, the capture of the leader of the
Yes.
This is a cabinet, Mario Trujillo, that we've been talking about. President Peña Nieto, the new president, came back and, I mean, his party came back to power in December, and he made a promise that, A, he would bring down the violence, and, B, they would try to focus on other things that just, what you know, it wasn't just organized crime, focus on the economy, et cetera. This week, I think, was a significant turning point in the sense that if you want to bring violence down, you got perhaps the man who has in many ways, I guess this defined the decade, the last 10 years of these terrible, grisly headlines. He's in jail, so that's a big deal for Mexico. People also expect that maybe in the next few weeks, few months, you might see another spike in violence as people try to fill the void that this guy left. But in general, you know, the hope is that things can calm down, that Americans can revisit Mexico and feel more comfortable traveling through Mexico, and the Mexicans themselves can breathe a sigh of relief.
Hmm. We're visiting with Alfredo Corchado about his book, Midnight in Mexico. You know, you talk at length in this book about the threats you yourself received from the cartels. What happened to you, and how did you react to it, Alfredo?
You know, when I started covering this, I the first to admit, I was very naive. I didn't really understand the dynamics of organized crime. So the first few signs, it was something that I just kind of looked the other way. I said, well, you know, this is part of covering Mexico. This is part of the beat. But when you get a call from a very trusted U.S. source who says, listen, there's a list that came out, three names on it. I think it's you. I would get out. I mean, I took that very seriously.
Mm.
My first reaction was, I mean, I was paralyzed from fear, didn't want to really admit it, and kept thinking, okay, maybe they have the wrong guy. Maybe the intelligence is raw. So the immediate thought is, okay, I got to get back to the U.S. And I did talk to my editor. They said, you know, get on the first flight. But my second concern was I have family in Mexico. And I thought, if these guys are serious about sending the message, they can't get me. Will they get a family member, a loved one, a friend? So I stayed in Mexico for a week, tried to get to the bottom of it. I got, I think, closer to the truth, but never really got to the bottom. I eventually left Mexico for about 2 years and came back not because I have a death wish, but
I was gonna say.
I really think, I mean, I really think the U.S. journalists, I mean, I think we have a protection, which is called a U.S. passport, and I'm hopeful, and I always knock on wood. I want to believe that my government will stand up and will do more to protect me than what the government here has done to protect their own Mexican journalists, which is practically nothing.
Well, has it caused you to
pull? It's a story that has to be told.
And listen, you're talking to a journalist, and I applaud and appreciate what you're doing. Has it caused you to pull your punches at all down there?
It really hasn't. I think what it's done, it's made me embrace my own fear. It made me understand that fear is actually a good security mechanism.
Hmm.
I think in the beginning I wouldn't say I was cocky, but I was a bit reckless, I would say, trying to run away from fear, saying, no, these guys aren't going to do anything. I now really think about it differently, and if I'm scared, I will admit to it, and I will tell my editors, and we talk about it, you know. that kind of stuff. I mean, I think it's made me change. It's made me understand or at least study the consequences a lot more closely than I did before.
Let's talk about the title for this book, Midnight in Mexico. There's a lot to it. Can you tell us how it is both, what, a literal reference and I guess a metaphor too?
Well, I first have to tell you and your listeners, it's a title that my mother hated at the beginning. I mean, when I first told her what this is the name of the book, she says, "Why would you do that? This is, you know, this is your country. This is where you were born." But it really came from that night when the U.S. forced call and said, you know, there's a death threat and they're going to kill an American journalist in 24 hours. And I sat there. I mean, I just tossed in bed the whole night. And to me, it was the longest night. It was a dark night, and you're literally looking for a crack of light, just a sliver of light, and you keep thinking and believing in the promise of a new day. So that's really how the whole title came about. I mean, I guess it's a metaphor for the promise of a new day. But when you look at the last 10, 12 years in Mexico, I mean, I think it's been really a nightmare for many of us. Seeing it as witnesses, as U.S. journalists, but also for Mexicans themselves.
Yeah.
So that's really what the title means. You know, it's believing that there is a dawn in Mexico.
You know, you thought at one point in your life that you were destined for a life working in the fields. What inspired you to get out? How did that happen?
Actually, you know, that's a great question. I was working as a kid. We had just moved from Mexico. We were working in the fields in San Joaquin Valley. My parents worked for the USW. Operated by Cesar Chavez, the union leader. I was a 13-year-old kid. I was not supposed to be out in the fields. I was underage. And a TV crew comes up to me and starts asking me all these questions, you know, what's it like, blah, 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 working in the fields. My parents were just paranoid. They thought, oh, my God, if he says the wrong answer, they're going to deport us back to Mexico, even though we had green cards. But they were just that afraid. That just left this incredible... had an incredible impact on me that I thought, wow, someone wants to listen to what I have to say. They want to give me a voice. And I think that was kind of the beginning of, you know, wouldn't it be cool someday to do something like that? And when the idea came about that I could be a foreign correspondent, I could go back to Mexico and tell stories, I mean, it was just the perfect scenario.
Alfredo Corchado's new book, Midnight in Mexico. Again, he joined us this morning from Mexico City. Alfredo, thank you for your time, and by all means, be safe down there, okay?
Steve, thank you very much. A pleasure.
All the best. You bet.
Bye.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're journeying through a whole series of books from my bookshelf, books that have caught my eye that I'm especially interested in getting to this summer. And our final book today is A Nation Turned to Watch John Glenn, Alan Shepard, and Gus Grissom being launched into space. Their wives remained on Earth rooting for them and waiting for their safe return. Their time in the public eye is chronicled in a new book, The Astronaut Wives Club, by our next guest, Lily Coppell. She's a writer who's been published in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and Glamour. This is her second book. And Lily, welcome. Nice to have you this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
How much pressure was on these women back in the early 1960s?
Well, I think often the women felt like they themselves were on the launch pad when watching their husbands go up.
Yeah.
And literally, some have phrased it to me as going through my own personal countdown. It would start about a month before their husbands went up, and, you know, it would involve hot flashes, not being able to eat, have your fellow friends and astro-wives, as they were called back in the day, you know, urge you to not lose too much weight. But, you know, it was a nail-biting experience, and it wasn't only the pressure of watching your husband being launched into space on these very dangerous rockets, which especially in the early days were blowing up in tests in front of the wives' eyes, and
yes,
they would joke and say, you know, thank God the monkey wasn't in that one.
They had a real gallows humor, a sense of humor about this whole thing, just from reading the book.
They did, and, you know, they had to. They had to rely on humor and camaraderie to get them through this brave new experience, which was being an astronaut wife. And, you know, these women, in a way, were like America's first reality stars.
Absolutely.
They go from being unknown military wives living on dusty air bases around the country. And then when their husbands were picked as the Mercury 7 astronauts in 1959, their lives were completely turned inside out, and all of a sudden Jackie Kennedy wants to have tea with them at the White House. Mm. They're being on, you know, presented on the cover of Life magazine, and they're really being held up as ideal specimens of the perfect American housewife, even when they have no idea how they've exactly landed in that crazy position.
Lily Coppell is our guest. Her new book, The Astronaut Wives Club. You know, how many of the original Mercury program wives are still with us?
Well, quite a few. Joe Schirra, Annie Glenn, Betty Grissom,
wow,
and Reen Carpenter.
And they talked to you?
They did. The only wife that I didn't spend time with was Annie Glenn. But the book covers not only the Mercury program, but through Gemini and Apollo as well. So then you have a whole new group of wives coming in the early and mid-60s, whose husbands are going to man the missions to the moon as well. So it really spans the generations.
Annie Glenn has a very serious stutter. I'm wondering, was that the reason she didn't want to visit, or was all of this just sort of water over the bridge for her at this point in her life?
Well, some of the other wives said it was perhaps because of her stutter, which she did overcome. But I think that, you know, it's something that you never quite get over. But, you know, these women were in the public eye like you can't imagine, you know, and it takes, you know, the coverage of people like the Kardashians in a way to a whole nother level, because it was really unprecedented at the time. I mean, they went from being, you know, down-to-earth mothers to all of a sudden having a contract with Life magazine for $500,000, which meant that journalists and photographers were embedded in their suburban homes in the so-called space burbs, where they lived outside of NASA's operations in Houston. Betty Grissom and Joe Schirra, who were next-door neighbors, they actually built their homes without windows in the front to protect their families from the press, and had a little... had a little almost rabbit hole built into the fence behind their home so that they could creep back and forth without the press seeing them on launch day.
Well, you had to have a solid marriage to get into the Mercury program, but you found out that just maybe some of these marriages weren't all that rock solid after all.
Exactly. Well, the book is really about cracking that facade of what it means to, you know, what an American hero is and what it meant to be a perfect astronaut wife back in the day. You know, the women felt that they had to sort of project that perfect jello mold image to the whole world. And it was part of the Cold War mission, if you will, that was sort of heaped on top of the wives. But of course, you know, things at home were not always perfect. They never are. Trudy and Gordo Cooper, Gordo being one of the original seven Mercury astronauts, they were actually divorced. Gordo had been having a little bit too much fun on the side, and Trudy, who was very adventurous, she was an aviatrix. She had left him, and they had two little girls, Cam and Jan. And Gordo, when he thought he was going to be picked, he made a visit out to Trudy, and he explained to her what an incredible opportunity this was. And they got back together for the sake of the space race, because there was no way he was going to be picked without that perfect wife at home.
I was going to say, some of these guys became so famous, they actually had their own groupies, right?
Yes. The adorably or eyebrow-raisingly named for the wives, Cape Cookies, down at Cape Canaveral, later Cape Kennedy.
Cookies.
Yeah, they followed the guys around like they were the Beatles, and would even drop to their knees occasionally when they walked into a party or a hotel. The guys all stayed in their families at the Holiday Inn down in Cocoa Beach for $1 a night, as well as getting $1 a year Corvettes. And the Cape Cookies, in a way, were part of the goodies, but not for the wives.
Huh. How much rivalry did there come to be between these different wives as they as this whole program began to proceed?
Well, it was an incredibly competitive environment. You know, you have all these alpha dog astronauts, really hot, test pilots all vying for the same flights, and especially when you get into who's going to be first on the moon, who's going to get a moon flight, the ante is upped even more. And this, of course, spread to the wives as well. So starting in the early days, because they got very little support from NASA in, you know, in just how to deal with the public and how to deal with being in the public eye, from the beginning, the wives really figured that if there was any way they were going to sort of survive in this cutthroat, competitive NASA world, they really had to rely on each other and remain above the competition, which they tried their best to maintain.
I was going to say, how successful were they at that?
Well, it wasn't always easy, you know, and there were really trying moments. Like 8 astronauts were lost on the path to the moon in T-38 crashes, in an automobile accident, and in the Apollo 1 fire when a flash fire killed 3 astronauts on the ground. And so the women really banded together during these moments and were each other's support and, you know, in an almost tribal environment. They were living in this little bubble world of subdivisions known as Togethersville at the time by journalists. And so they were just a lawn or a phone call away and would dash to be with each other in any trying moment. But then there would also be, you know, hard things to deal with, like if your husband was lost, having another woman's husband replace your husband on that flight that was supposed to be, you know, your man and your true love's glory of getting to the moon or getting into space. And that's a hurt that still stings for these women.
Lily Coppell's new book, The Astronaut Wives Club. You know, speaking of sort of the tensions and the rivalry between the men and between the women, too, there's a story behind the cover photograph of this book and the outfit that one of the wives wore. Tell us about that.
It's very cute. This was the wives' first life shoot, and they were all told to wear these perfect pastel shirtwaist dresses just so they could all look like a perfect scoop of ice cream, and they were to be they were to be arranged around the Mercury capsule, which really looks quite flimsy, which their husbands were about to ride into space. Well, Reen Carpenter, who is beautiful and blonde, and JFK later said he found her the most attractive of the astronaut wives, she said there was no way she was going to let the government tell her what to wear to the other wives, and she showed up in this flowered number, sort of splashed with these big red roses and wearing red high heels, and, you know, the other wives were really wowed, you know. There was the rebel of the group, and, you know, lest anyone think that this is a story that's all about martinis and beehives and deviled eggs, Reen was really a breath of fresh air because she started cracking that perfect astro wife facade from the beginning in asserting her personality, and would go on to write an opinionated women's column. And by the end of the book, has divorced her astronaut and is hosting a feminist talk show. And
wow.
Looking
wow.
a bit like Gloria Steinem.
I was going to say, you wonder how some of the marriages were impacted by all this sudden publicity and how they sort of weathered this absolute avalanche of reporters and photographers.
Well, it's part of the emotional cost of the space program, which the book explores. And out of 30 space couples, I was very surprised to learn at the beginning of the writing process that only 7 have survived to this day. And it really was...
Survive being married.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. There were many divorces, and it was sort of the fallout of going to the moon. A lot of the guys sort of changed, I think, because of their experience. And the wives changed, too. And, of course, it was the 60s and the 70s. But, you know, one poignant moment, Joan Aldrin, Buzz's wife, when he was second to land on the moon, lent me her diary that she kept on the incredible round-the-world trip they took after the Apollo 11 crew came back. And there is a moment where they were sharing a nightcap. And Joan was saying to Buzz, you know, I think in time things will return to normal. And I think many of the wives were waiting for their husbands to come back to Earth, waiting for their, you know, heroes who had been absentee fathers to assume their place in the family again. And Buzz turned to Joan and he said, Joan, I've been to the moon. Nothing's ever going to be the same.
Wow. Wow.
And for them, it wasn't.
Lily Coppell is the author of The Astronaut Wives Club. Lily, thanks so much for the time. The book sounds very compelling. We appreciate your time very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. For more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Caitlin Brennan, and Sangeeta Shastri. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.